This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In this show, we'll cover growing your own food right where you are on a city lot with urban farming pioneer Jules Dervais. Then I'll ask author Richard Heinberg if the money system can survive the end of growth. But first, what if you face an emergency quite different than the TV told you? Whether it's a hurricane, a forest fire, or just unheard-of blasts of rain or snow, I always wonder, how do so many people die in these things, even when they have a lot of warning? You and I are much too smart to be caught out in a natural disaster, aren't we? We're informed, we're prepared, we're not the type. Really? One of the smartest people I know has a tale to tell you about hurricanes, hubris, and hot water. Dr. Kathy McMahon is a psychologist, now specializing in, quote, the emotional reactions to peak oil, climate change, and economic collapse. And that's a quote from the masthead of her popular blog, Peak Oil Blues. Our interview last year was in the top 20 Radio EcoShock downloads. Let's find out how our conceptions can lead into danger and how to plan smarter for emergencies. Kathy, I'm really pleased to have you back on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You were in New England when Hurricane Irene came roaring through. Tell us what happened just getting caught out there and getting home.
Well, you know, the story is not all that fascinating to begin with because, like a lot of people caught in dangerous situations, we had no idea that the situation that we were caught in was as dramatic and dangerous as it was. We were at a friend's wedding in the middle of Vermont, and it was an idyllic day on Saturday, and we just had a lot of fun and stayed up late and decided that, you know, we're going to get up early, but with all of our reverie, we slept in a little bit later and left at 8 o'clock. And, you know, we were expecting the storm to hit a little bit later on, you know, maybe middle afternoon. So we headed home. And the one thing that we kept noticing was that we never got the really tropical force winds we were expecting. So we kept thinking to ourselves, well, the hurricane hasn't hit in this area yet. And then we would notice a tree would be down on the interstate. So we would slow down and kind of move around the interstate and keep going, and that happened on two different occasions. But still, we were continuing to wait for this tropical wind that was going to be so devastating and so dangerous. So we decided to stop for a gas, and we learned later, I have on my website a picture of the town Deerfield where we stopped to get gas, and it was raining, but again, no tropical force winds. We got the gas and decided that maybe we should take the quicker way home rather than the highway. So we started to do that and wind our way through some of the smaller streets in Western Mass, and lo and behold, we had to stop because a town became a river. The road was completely covered with rushing water. And at that point, we realized that we weren't in Kansas anymore. It was a shocking experience for us. And, of course, the road wasn't closed. We were able to drive right down there. And if we weren't looking, or maybe we're foolish enough to think that maybe we could cross the river that was once the highway anyway, or the road, we would be dead. But we turned around, and to make a long story short, we went the rest of the way on the highway that we could because we live in a hilly area. We had to take some smaller roads, and we were continually confronted with roadblocks, police barricades. And the longer that it took us to get home, the more dangerous it became. And like I said, only later on did we realize that the gale force winds we were expecting was not the true danger. The true danger was the flooding, and it wasn't something that was in our mental map to even recognize that that was what we needed to look out for.
And that's so interesting because we do have these mental maps, and people had it for that storm. They said, oh, it's going to knock out New York City, but it was really Vermont and the New England states that got hit so hard. What do you make of this phenomenon that we have a conception and that actually can be dangerous for us when a real emergency arises?
Well, I think that our mind, our ability to imagine what is true from what is false, gives us a blueprint for what we should look for. And in my case, what we were looking for was serious wind. And so we took precautions and kept expecting to see serious winds. And later I found out that we aren't alone, that more than 80% of people in a hurricane are really worried about, very concerned about high winds, but only half of that 80%, 40%, are really concerned about flooding. And yet flooding is a much greater danger. So one of the things that I think is really important for anyone to realize when they're facing natural disasters like that is to be able to see what's in front of them as evidence for that danger and not to make assumptions that what they imagine is the danger is the only thing that could be out there. For them to be able to, moment by moment, assess what they're seeing and make a judgment on that and not stick with that image that they have in their mind about what is and what isn't dangerous.
And I think that's probably what kept certain humans alive over the ages and not others, is just to be there in real time and say, well, this is what's actually happening. It wasn't what I expected, but this is what is happening.
Yeah, rigid people are dangerous people in survival situations because they have a plan and they are going to stick to that plan come hell or high water.
And I don't know why George Bush comes to mind, but we won't go there. Well, in the larger scale of things, you had a second sort of learning experience when you arrived home because your base of operations, so to speak, wasn't ready either, even though you're kind of a prepper kind of person.
And again, all of these things seem mundane until an emergency happens. And when emergencies happen, even something as everyday as a house that isn't organized and cleaned in preparation, we had been busy on the property making sure that all the things on the outside of the property was picked up. We took any of the possible flying objects that could break our window. We took them and put them into a safekeeping. But we hadn't looked inside to decide what our life would be like if we had no electricity. So we had to do the setup, which we had, fortunately, of getting a camp stove up and running to heat hot water and that sort of thing. But we were also fighting against not knowing how long the electricity would be out. And one of the things that I think is really important is for people to recognize that putting things in order in their house when they're expecting something like a hurricane, cleaning, doing laundry, that sort of thing, is it's equally as important as, you know, getting their medications or getting water.
Right. The best way to be ready is to be ready. Well, on another frontier, and I know you looked into this, what is the best way to die in a big storm? How do people go?
Oh, you know, I noticed with this particular hurricane that people die in a variety of ways, not the least of which is they think, for example, that they can make it as they're traveling through a puddle, and they find out differently. 6 inches of water is the deepest that many cars need to start to lose control. So we've had people in this hurricane get into accidents because they simply hit a puddle of water and lost control of their car and died. Or they had their car floating away and they actually drown in the car themselves. We also had people, a young boy, for example, and another woman die when a tree fell down on their house, crushed their roof, and crushed them. So, you know, old trees can kill you if they're hanging over your house. Electrocution is not uncommon. People will think that if they don't step on electrical wires, then they won't get hurt. But when it's raining, the water itself can, the electricity can travel through the water, and electricity itself can cause severe burns with people. And the other thing, and this is sort of dangerous in the sense that people don't think about it, so many of the deaths in hurricanes happen after the storm is over. When people are starting to clean up, they are without electricity. They can die from hypothermia, being overheated. They can die from carbon monoxide poisoning because They will power up their generators. And for many people, they're fearful that their generators will be stolen. So instead of putting it 50 feet away from their home, which is what's recommended, they'll put it in their garage or they'll put it in their basement. And quite a few people die every single year from carbon monoxide poisoning. And sometimes the reasons that they'll power up that generator is not for survival reasons, but because they're bored. They're trying to entertain children, or they're trying to, entertain themselves by watching television. Candles can burn their house down. Some people are going to be lighting in a variety of different ways, and candles start fires. Other kinds of burning items can cause fires, and even flooding basements themselves can be very dangerous. So I think that there's any number of ways that people can end up dead when it seems mundane. Even the hurricane itself may not to other people look like it was very severe, and yet somebody who's cutting a tree with a chainsaw in their driveway to move it away and only takes that chainsaw out once a year can severely cut their leg and have to rush to the hospital to get services. And if their road is out, they may well bleed to death unless they have medical attention right where they are.
Well, I think we've learned a lot already. I want to say this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the peak oil shrink, Dr. Kathy McMahon. We're talking about lessons learned from natural disasters, and they can strike anywhere. It could even be an earthquake or a tsunami, but these days more of these threats are supercharged by climate disruption. Wherever you live, maybe it's time to think about shelter and adaptation. Kathy, you brought up a really intriguing book about defensive gardening, I think. What is that?
It's by Charles Smith, and the name of it is The Weather Resilient Garden, A Defensive Approach to Planning and Landscaping. And one of the things I really like about this book is that it really is oriented towards any kind of climate that you live in. And the ways, you know, for our area, I was very concerned about forest fire. And so one of the things that we did, because we don't live in a very hot area, is that we cut down a number of trees within a certain number of feet around our house. And when we arrived home, I'll tell you, we were pretty relieved to know that we didn't have a tree hanging over our roof. So it's a book that's very helpful in being able to point out the kinds of natural disasters that can impact various areas and the types of landscaping that you should be considering doing in order to protect your home and your family from those kinds of disasters.
You know, I think I'm going to get that book. I would like to read it myself. Well, another big issue seems to be road damage. There were hundreds of bridges knocked out around New England alone, and people, even smart people, think they'll just drive out of a disaster, maybe in their SUV or a camper. Is that realistic from what you've just experienced?
Absolutely not. In fact, one of the decisions that we had to make is whether we were going to stay in that small Vermont town for another day and wait for the hurricane to pass, or we were going to drive home. And what we found out was that the groom's parents actually went out quickly to pick up something on the other side of town, and the bridge in the town went out, and they had to rent another hotel room because they weren't able to get back to their original one. And many towns in Vermont have actually been stranded, and they've had to fly in food and supplies. The bride tells me that in the hotel she was staying in, they were very nice, and they had leftover food, and they were cooking it up for them. Very often, if you're not home and you're thinking that you can get home, I think that for us, one of the scariest moments was when we realized that we may not be able to get home, that we just had assumed once we got home we were fine. But the idea that the roads were closed, the roads were flooded, in some cases the roads just fell off. I mean, you'd drive and then all of a sudden there would be no road in front of you. It was absolutely terrifying.
Kathy McMahon, you also study economic distress. Are we at the point yet where some of this road infrastructure may not be repaired at all because governments at all levels, states, municipal, and the federal government certainly, because they're so broke?
Well, remember, this is the first hurricane of the season. And one of the things that we have to think about is perhaps in some of the major cities, these roads will certainly be replaced. But the farther out you get, the more remote the towns, the smaller the towns, the more strapped the federal government will be for funds, the less likely they'll be repaired to the standard that they may have been repaired 10 years ago. And then the next hurricane comes, and there's more road damage because it wasn't repaired fully and thoroughly the first time. We have the National Guard around our area right now, and we have a section of Route 91. Interstate highways are built to the standard to withstand 100-year floods. We have sections of an interstate highway that have washed out, that are not accessible to traffic, even today, Wednesday. So as a result, yeah, I think we will inevitably see a situation where not only towns and cities and even the federal government will have increasing difficulty in coming up with the funds to replace all of the damage that's done. But I think increasingly you'll also see insurance coverage and flood insurance becoming so prohibitive that people will be left living someplace that they can't sell because the next person who comes in will not be able to afford the flood insurance. And yet at the same time, when this damage happens, they won't have the funds to repair their home. So you'll end up seeing, I think, some homelessness as a result of this as well. In the town we were in, a photography studio, literally washed away. The entire building washed into the river. In that particular case, they had flood insurance. To some extent, they will be able to rebuild. I hear that right now there's thoughts that the insurance itself may pay 40% of the kinds of damage that this flood has caused. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what we'll see. We'll see people, you know, in a situation where increasingly they will repeatedly need to pay large deductibles in order to repair the damage that these storms are doing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We are talking the aftermath of Hurricane Irene with New England resident and psychologist Kathy McMahon. Find her blog at peakoilblues.org. Kathy, there have been hard times all through history. The last century went through a major depression and two ugly world wars. Do you think that we're coming into one of those really hard times now?
I think we're in it. I think that things are already difficult for a huge number of people. Unemployment is very high. There's a largest number of people on food stamps in the United States than has ever been on food stamps before. And I think increasingly you will see, as we're seeing now, states becoming increasingly bankrupt, cities that aren't able to pay pensions, people who've had the assumption that they will be comfortable in their retirement will suddenly be without those funds and have to rely on younger their kids and younger people, which will stress the entire family. So I think that sometimes when we think about a Great Depression, we really forget that during the last Great Depression, there wasn't a sign out that said, by the way, you're in a Great Depression. And people just learn to adapt and live through their everyday life. And I think that's what we're doing now, that each of us will think when we lose our job that it's a personal problem. And even though we'll hear and we'll read on the news and on wonderful programs like yours that unemployment happens, we still tend to personalize, and we have a very difficult time fathoming that this is happening on a global level. This is not simply a personal problem that affects each and every family to one extent or another.
Well, given that, Kathy McMahon, I can find a lot of survival how-to information on the net, but what I can't find so easily is how to cope with all this bad news and worry emotionally. What are some of the things you recommend for emotional preparedness?
Well, I think that the best thing that you can do is to be able to accept the fact that these are stressful times. And the problem is not that you're feeling anxiety. Anxiety is a perfectly appropriate reaction to uncertainty. The issue is how you'll deal with that stress, how you'll deal with that anxiety. And the first thing is to be able to accept the fact that you're going to feel that. And the second thing is to be able to learn the very many ways that are out there for coping with stress. And some of those ways are idiosyncratic. Some of those ways are positive and lead to you further having a clear mind and a healthy body. And some of those are going to lead to the opposite, drugs and alcohol being one of the exceptions. It may relieve the stress initially, but long term, if it becomes a pattern of adapting. And of course, the other key thing is we need each other. People need to be able to get together more often in groups, in families, extended family situations, in dances, that kind of thing. And I think, unfortunately, when we face stress, particularly when we face unemployment and that sort of thing, we tend to withdraw from those kind of social connections. So I think that just getting together with other people, having a dinner, socializing, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but being with other people and being able to commiserate or perhaps just have a mindless diversion can be a really useful way of coping with things.
And there you have it. Psychologist Kathy McMahon is one of the best out there, I think, when it comes to prepping the mind for future stress. Check out Kathy's blog at peakoilblues.org. Kathy, thank you for sharing your lessons learned from Hurricane Irene in New England 2011.
My pleasure.
Radio EcoShock.
Coming up next, City Farming. Feed yourself where you are.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the 1980s, when I was hacking away brush on a 200-acre homestead in Wayback Country, Jewel Dervais and his family stayed home. They turned a city lot in Pasadena, California, into a food-producing mini-farm with a philosophy that anyone can do it. The Dervais family have defined a new way of sustainable city living. Jules Dervais, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So, how is the harvest this year?
Okay, well, I say it's up and down. We're experiencing shocks this year that we've kind of never had before, so it's a new experience for us. We thought we had our act together, and that's always the optimism in me, but we've seen quite a bit of problems. There's been, of course, the weather gyrations, but we've had more than our share of downs. This looks like it'll be a down year. We have up and downs for the last 10 years, but this one will be when it gets to the end, when we tally the produce January 1st, it'll probably be one of our lower years.
And how much do you normally produce in a year, just to give our listeners an idea?
Okay, well, we started out with 2,300 pounds back in 2001, and our highest we got was in 2010 was 7,000 pounds of fruits and vegetables on a tenth of an acre garden. And in between, it's been all over the place. But this, what bothers me now is we should be getting better, and yet we can't really control the weather. So it's like it's new to us what nature throws at us.
It's terrible here in British Columbia. The spring was just so late and so wet and so cold. A lot of people are complaining they just couldn't get their crops to fruit properly and other problems.
That's correct. I mean, we're the same thing here, except in the other way. We got too dry. Everything that we have is almost extreme, so they call it global weirding instead of global warming. It's you get it all around the country, all around the world, is that there's no one mean temperature or low or high where you can average it out. It's way spiking all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least we're not in Texas where they don't get any rain at all.
Yeah, they really spike in bad there. I mean, with the wildfires now, they're paying for years of drought. With on top of that, they get fire. Yeah.
Well, you're still talking about a lot of food this year. What do you do with it all?
Well, we tried it. We started out trying to feed our family, myself and my three adult children here. We've been working on feeding ourselves, but we did pretty well. And we're in the city, so this in Southern California, they have a lot of these trendy restaurants. So we were able to convert some of our surplus vegetables and produce into cash, so we can buy stuff that we can't grow on the farm here. So there's a little bit of a side business. It's when it's up and down like this to this year, the side business has to suffer, but we still feed ourselves. You know, that's what the blessing is.
Yes, indeed. Well, I want to get back to the sort of big picture of what this all means, but can we start with a few tips? There are people out there who want to do what you're doing. Let's start with the basics, which is soil. How should we prepare city soil and make it so it's productive year after year?
Right. Well, that's a good question, and it depends on what soil you start with. We started with sort of a, like an adobe-type soil that became hard as a rock when the sun would bake it. And so we had to amend it a lot. We started composting almost 25 years ago when I bought the property. We wouldn't throw away any of our waste, especially our kitchen waste. We would bury it, and it came home that the soil got better. Some places are better than others, but in the city, you know, you have to take, you can't do too much. You're stuck with what you have. And so we've basically composted everything that we could ever get our hands on. And so much as we brought in wood chips from the outside, and people throw away, here they throw away straw, hay bales that they use for decoration around Halloween and Thanksgiving. We go and collect that, and we add to the soil. Now, you can purchase organic mixes now, which we didn't have to have available a couple of years back, but now they're available at nursery centers if you get the organic compost.
And some people, they're just renting, so they don't have a lot of choices, and they've got big asphalt driveways and paved patios. Can they still use that space?
Well, yeah, that's what we have that too. That's what we started out with. We had a big 40-foot by 40-foot slab in the backyard. They used it as a business. He had a trucking business, so the person we bought the house from. And we stuck with a lot of concrete, a lot of places that are small. We turned to container gardening, and they have a new container gardening situation now where they have self-watering pots and self-watering boxes. And so you can start a little mini garden on decks, on patios, and on concrete areas. And you can definitely get some salads and some, you know, these tomatoes and stuff that is, you know, very good for homegrown produce. You know, you can get that right away without the land. Now, if you're fortunate enough to have some land, even along the fence line, you can grow beans, pole beans, and squash along the fence line. So you're got to use all available space, but definitely look into containers.
And it must take a lot of water to grow so much, especially in Southern California. Can you give us any tips about your water management?
Yes, the watering situation here is a challenge, always will be, looks like, until we get enough rain. But one of the things we do is we plant closer together than you see out in the fields. The fields spacing, when they normally give you the spacing in the books, how far apart to space the plants, that's basically for tractors and running equipment down the rows. We plant closer together, so we hope to have the leaves touch to form a canopy, which would then shade the ground below it and create a microclimate so that there's some cooler and damper weather below the surface. And we're trying to do what they call a food forest. So you want to get as close as you can without getting too much, too damp. And so it's a lot of experimentation. But what we do is water in the mornings or in the evenings so that there's no evaporation. And we hand water, and we also use what they call ollas. I don't know if you've seen that on our website.
No, I haven't seen it.
But they're old. They're clay. There's an old form of drip irrigation, about 2,000 to 3,000 years old, that they plant a unglazed clay pot in the ground, and they fill it with water, and it seeps out as needed. So it saves overhead watering, and it goes right to the drip zone of the plant underneath in the root zone, and it's underneath the plant real close by, so it just feeds that plant, so you don't have many weeding problems too. So it's a good form. We're heavy into conservation of water since we don't have much. Now, other people, they obviously have the opposite problem. They have too much water, so, you know, it's always a challenge.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with Jules Dervais and more secrets of food self-sufficiency, even from a small city lot.